Yeah, I mean, in general, I, like, don't watch prestige television shows. I also just finished The Terror for, let's just say it's on my comrade's top 10 list of the year that we're planning our episode soon, so I'm working through a lot of cool stuff from his list. And the show, AMC's The Terror, that stars Jared Hess, it's about, like, it takes place in, like, 1847 on two ships trapped in the Arctic, and mysterious things and madness and monsters destroy them slowly over 10 episodes. And I was just bored out of my mind. There's something about when it's always a thing, and it will always be a thing for me, when a 10-hour show could have been a 2-hour movie, mm-hmm. and I'm stuck watching. And then a 2-hour movie, which could have been a 70-minute pre-code movie, is always my thing.
Right.
Yep, there's that too. Well, so if people don't recognize the voices, we go in alphabetical order. So, Mark, hello again.
Hello again, sir.
My first time talking to you in the new digs, but and our last show of the year, so good to see you again.
Yeah, you too, sir.
And I like the Bills hat, by the way.
Thank
the
you. Bills. Go Bills.
And Peter Labuza from a lot of things, but I guess you're the Cinephiliacs, yes.
Yeah, the Cinephiliacs podcast. Yeah, I'd say that's my main affiliation, and I'm guessing the affiliation of some of your audience that might know me.
Yes. If they don't, Peter, they should.
They should, yeah. And Peter, it's been a long time coming, but yeah, you're a voice we respect, and I think we've interacted with on social media, a lot of mutual friends as well. So great to have you. I think we're in good company with talking about art, film, Criterion. And in fact, and butter you up a little bit, I was telling a friend that I was going to have you on, that we were going to have you on, and we were talking about your podcast. And the fact that you kind of read a monologue at the beginning is pretty unique.
Is it? I'm not sure. I guess it is, maybe. But I've been starting to cut that down and everything. But
no, I think it's interesting. And then, yeah. But then you get into so what my friend pointed out is that you really get to the heart of film. You know, we kind of get into collecting and news, and you know, we touch on film art, but. They said that every episode they'll take 5 things from you that they make note of. And I enjoy the episodes. I don't get to podcast or listen as much as anymore, but yeah, you're doing great work. So
your research seems second to none to your guest, and I know you talked about that some, Peter, in the 100th episode, which I loved how you got turned. Keith got to interview you and get some insights into you, but your research into the subject that you're interviewing and also the film that you're talking about. So it's amazing. It shows. So good work.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I'm just glad the show keeps going. You know, we're going into our 7th year next year. And
that's amazing.
You know, it's as I'm sure as you guys know, it's always hard to keep a podcast going. That always seems to be the hardest part of running with other things going on in your life. But I've just, started planning. I've got about 6 interviews set up for next year that I'm all really, really excited about. Some really amazing guests coming up, and it's always a pleasure that anyone listens to it and finds value in it. So thank you guys so much for the comments.
Yeah,
yeah, and you actually do research. See, here we fake it really, really well.
No, see, kidding. That's the part I like, is doing the research, and then it's the recording part I want to skip right through.
Okay, it's sort of like practice versus game day. You prefer the practice, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Or it's like when Alfred Hitchcock famously said, I forget for which film or something, he finished the storyboarding and he's like, oh, now I have to go do the shooting of it, but the movie's done. The storyboards were all that mattered.
That sounds very Hitch-ish. So we have a big show today. It's been a couple weeks because I moved, so yay.
Yeah, Aaron. And, congratulations.
So, congrats.
Yeah, it's fun. So, and hopefully the show will come out fine. I think it will. I'm in this new podcast studio. Do you guys see TV in the background?
Oh, there it is.
We do.
Yeah. I thought about playing movies, but I was like, man, maybe I'll spoil movies for people. But I could just put on like Kurosawa's Dreams and just make everybody.
Right. Or Rashomon. We'll just get different perspectives throughout the podcast.
I think maybe James Benning, just 13 Lakes, and people can see 13 Lakes through the recording.
Perfect.
There you go. Yeah, there's lots of options. But and really, who cares about spoilers, right? So if you don't mind real quick, since it's been a while, we have a few Patreon shout outs. New subscribers, and I'll just make this quick because there's four of them. So I only know a couple. So the most recent was Yancey Garrido. I know another Yancey. It's a unique name, but not this one. But thank you for the support. And then we have Greg Anderson, who I think we've interacted with in social media. I'm pretty sure we have.
I think you're right, Aaron.
Then we have Scott Pollard, who we've interacted with. He's been a Criterion Cast supporter since for years, and it's good to have him on the boat. And then Becky Deanna, who is a very good friend. Actually, I think she probably just wanted to hear her Bergman Box episode rather than wait for me to edit it. So she's on there as well.
Excellent. So maybe we'll get some Patreon donations with every future centennial box set, Aaron. I know that's a lot to hope for and ask for, but we'll see. Mm-hmm.
Every centennial box set will fill our coffers.
Right.
So anyway, Peter Labuza. So one thing, we used to do this a long time ago, and we kind of stopped, but I kind of thought it would be good to just ask you, since you're definitely a film art person. So we used to have this sequence about people's Criterion connection, when they learned about the Criterion collection. Do you have any neat tidbits like that?
It's almost like your first film memory, Peter, that you would ask your guests. We're asking you, what's your first Criterion film memory?
So I do actually. I can recall. Well, no. Okay, so there's two, I should say. I think I've told this story on my own podcast before, but when I was around 10 or 11 and my dad was depressed for some reason and wanted to watch a thing, and so he had a Laserdisc player. We didn't have that many Laserdiscs. It was like, I think there was Charlie Brown. There was a couple of like these like weird music video like things. But one of the Laserdiscs he did have was The Seventh Seal, the Ingmar Bergman film, which I believe would have been the Criterion Laserdisc at the time. Yeah. And this is about 95, 96 maybe or something. And I remember watching this really, really bizarre Swedish film that made no sense. I didn't understand why I had to watch subtitles. The thing I took away from amazing. It was being absolutely terrified by, I forget the performer who plays Death, but the image of Death in the black coat was just such iconic image. I think in a way that I knew what Death was or whatever, but I'd never seen it personified that way before, and it just scarred into my memory. Sweet. In a way that was really, really unexpected. When I first, I think, became aware of the Criterion Collection was, it was right on the cusp right before I got Netflix discs, but it was like I realized my Blockbuster didn't have certain things that I wanted to watch because I was kind of getting into sort of cinephile movies, and I was able to order a couple things off Amazon. And I remember this lasted for maybe, I only got, maybe 8 discs before, Netflix came along and my parents were like, oh, thank God, this is going to be so much cheaper. But it was I remember ordering Dr. Strangelove, but particularly the Criterion film I got was Seven Samurai. I mean, this was a time in which I was following the IMDb Top 250, not exactly the best list to follow. But at that time, Seven Samurai was in the top 10. And so it's like, let me watch this 3-hour samurai drama. And I loved it at the time. And I think, after that, I definitely became much more curious about Kurosawa Akira and wanted to dive into his material more and more.
So, Peter, can you talk about your writing and podcasting a little bit more?
Sure. I run the Cinephilex podcast. When, just for those who don't know, it's an interview show, long-form interviews with film critics, film programmers, archivists, academics, sometimes filmmakers. They sit down. It's about an hour-long interview often where we'll discuss their work, their research, their origins, whatever. I'll always ask them to choose a favorite film to discuss, and then we'll talk about that for a while as well. It's sort of like an incisive sort of halfway between the original idea of the show came out of WTF with Mark Maron, where it was sort of comics interviewing comics, where I originally started the show as critics interviewing critics. And then the mission, as I saw it, expanded from there to be much more inclusive and diverse of what cinephilia could do or mean. Outside of that, I've I should say I'm a former film critic now. I haven't done any extensive writing for a while. I've written for Variety, The Village Voice, Sight and Sound, other places, a lot of places that, of course, seem to have been dried up for various reasons, including The Voice and other internet sites. So this year, I mean, I wrote, yeah, my last written piece. I had the piece in The Voice in January for the Museum of Modern Arts to Preserve Film Preservation Festival. And then I wrote two essays this year for Kino Lorber's DVD collection, one on Manhandled, which is a Gloria Swanson silent from 1924. And then just most recently, which if people have gotten the Kino Lorber Women Pioneers box set, but yes, they're curious for more, I did the essay for Old Ironside, which is a Paramount epic, sort of a sea epic about the Battle of Tripoli in the early, about 1803. It's a Paramount epic directed by James Cruise, but the writer, editor, and almost the ghost director on the film is Dorothy Arzner, and it was her last film before she became a director. And of course, famously, she would be the only director with a full contract at any of the major studios from basically 1927 until Ida Lupino comes along in the 50s. So it's a pretty, you know, I was trying to use the essay to explore, you know, how her story is actually very different from a lot of the people who preceded her, like Lois Weber, Alice Guy Blaché, Ida Mae Park. These other people had come beyond. Beyond that, I'm a historian. I teach at University of Southern California, and I'm finishing my doctorate there. I'm working on my dissertation and what'll be a book in 4 to 5 years. It's about the history of entertainment law firms. It's sort of a new way to tell the story about the history of New Hollywood from more of a legal and business administrative sense. It starts at the Paramount decision in 1948 and ends with Bonnie and Clyde in 67, and tells about the story of these lawyers who invigorated the system and brought the economics of the studios with the artistic intentions of the directors together.
Wow, that's new ground. I guess there were the agents that came into play. I think there was a little overlap with the Wassermans and
yep. Yeah. And one of my big things is I say the agents aren't as important as they want to believe they are.
that's a good point to leave on. Well, and actually bookmark Kino Lorber. They've been doing some good work this year and mm-hmm. have a lot of good work coming up, and we're going to talk about them in a second. But just recently we had the March 2018 Criterion announcements, and if you're ready, we can run through those. By the way, we do have a lot to talk about here, so we might have to speed it up a little bit.
And sure.
So we have Harold Lloyd is back in the collection. About time. It's had been a while. I think the last one was Speedy, which was December, year before last.
I was going to say, yeah, 2 years, I think. Yep.
Excellent release. So we have The Kid Brother is coming out in March, on March 12th. And this is a Wild, yes, Ted Wild production. It's a new 4K digital restoration. A score from Carl Davis. I think most people know Carl Davis. And there's a whole ton of supplements. Another great cover, still from the shot, from the film, but very stylized font. And so, yeah, Harold Lloyd is coming back. Peter, are you a Harold Lloyd aficionado? Or?
Oh, definitely. I always love. I'm trying to remember if I've seen The Kid Brother or not. I'm reading over the plot summary right now, and it's. It's not coming to mind. I'm like trying to be like, I don't think I've seen this one. I always know they always pretty much have a Harold Lloyd or a Buster Keaton film when I go up to the San Francisco Silent Film Festival every June. And it's always great to see it, usually with a live orchestra performing the Carl Davis score.
That'd
which
be great.
Is fantastic.
Yeah.
Here. I guess I'm very excited. Just shout out on I see. I always like when Criterion adds the other restored shorts that have been they've been working on. And I see that there's a discussion of the two shorts here by USC archivist Dino Everett. Dino is a friend. He's really great. I'm guessing that's because these were restored on 9.5 millimeter film, and I wonder if that's what he's going to be discussing.
Huh. Oh, interesting. Yeah, we have another, and actually there were the rumors that there were going to be a box of, or maybe not a box, but there were rumors that there were more Harold Lloyd shorts coming to the collection. So that may be what this is, these early shorts, and there might be more coming. I don't know how many features are remaining from his career to be released, but because we have the four big ones now.
They could do some of the sound stuff, which is actually not bad.
Yeah, okay. I haven't seen the sound stuff, and I haven't seen this either. But yeah, it is loaded with supplements. And in fact, there's another friend of a friend that I think we're going to get on the show for around the time when this comes out to do an episode on. But yeah, a whole bunch here. There's an anatomy of a gag, which I think there's some variation of that for every Harold Lloyd released, and I just love kind of seeing behind the scenes with the gags. I mean, they're really for 1927. I mean, he's so sophisticated with what he put together, and just an interesting guy, of course, with his own injury and his hand issue. But yeah, I think this is the crown jewel of the month. Would you agree, Mark? Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I mean, as far as being stacked, this seems like the most stacked release of the month. I really kind of love the cover with the title, you know, where he's walking over his own movie title, mm-hmm. you know, and himself. But yeah, and it first time on Blu-ray. This was a part of a out of print Harold Lloyd collection DVD set New Line Cinema put out back in 2005. Mm-hmm. So that's gone. So yeah, 28 movies that one had. So this is very, wow. very welcome.
Yeah. Yeah. The cover, we should mention that I think all the Harold Lloyd covers have been fantastic. And I think they've all been by the same guy, F. Ron Miller. Is that right? So very good work there. I think Speedy's still my favorite, but yeah, this one looks splendid. So, yeah, more Lloyd. It's been rumored that when we do the predictions, I think Lloyd always is near the top. Lloyd and Chaplin, mm-hmm. they're like, come on, guys. And it's been a while for Chaplin, so.
Yeah.
And then we have, on the same day, we have a Splinter release from the Bergman box set. We have The Magic Flute, 1975. Wow, what a cover, guys. I don't know if you've seen this.
Great cover, yeah.
Really fantastic cover. And I like that they're, you know, they could easily just phone it in with some of these releases, since there are probably not a lot of people going to buy them. This was an mm-hmm. upgrade. Well, at least the people that have the set.
No, this isn't the cover that if you... I have not gotten the Bergman set. This is not the cover you'd get on the Bergman set, would it be?
No.
The Bergman set is they're really just sleeves, and it's...
Okay.
So there's really no cover. The cover is Persona, so...
Right.
But this one, and the cover for this one, since it was an early spine, the original was kind of elementary. I don't have it in front of me, but I can kind of visualize it. Oh, thank you, Mark. Yeah, see?
Got it. Yeah.
Yeah, it hasn't aged as well. It's fine. But...
And it has no supplements. I mean, it's just... The special features is about the transfer, so... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on that note, that we have a Bergman scholar, that pretty much omnipresent Bergman scholar, Peter Cowie, is mm-hmm. back, and we have a new interview with him. And I didn't check the box if this was on there, but I imagine it has to be.
I tried to do some research into that, Aaron, and I feel like none of these are, but it's just the way they have it worded. I couldn't quite search. My feeling, though, is that you're going to get some new supplements by buying this set, but I can't take that as gospel.
Yeah, and it's a new restoration. It's been a while since I've seen this one, and I think of a lot of the Bergmans from that era, I mean, this one kind of stands out as being, you know, stylistically very different, but yeah. I think it's the one I struggled with, but I watched it a while ago, so I'm curious if that'll change. Peter, have you seen The Magic Flute?
Yeah, I saw it a few years ago when I was living in New York on film, and it's, you know, it's a filmed opera. I mean, you know, I'm always curious about those directors who have made films of stage plays but are recording the stage play itself. People may not... Spike Lee has done this a couple of times. He actually did another film this year like that was released literally like the same week as Black Klansman. And it sort of just
went... Strange too, yeah.
Yeah, and Passing Strange. And it definitely feels like filmed opera. And so if, you know, you like, I don't remember much about it stylistically from the point of the filmmaker as much as from the point of, you know, Bergman is staging the opera and putting all of the, you know, the mise-en-scene together, the production design. And it's a well-done version of The Magic Flute, which is a great opera, of course. You know, it's certainly... It's certainly not for hardcore tourists. I wouldn't even say it's. I think it's less for a tourist than people who are interested in opera.
Right, right. It's and it, contrast that with like Tales of Hoffman, which is a filmed version of an opera. Still an opera, but it's a film, distinctly a film and stylistically a film. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess kind of like the what's the Wallace Shawn.
My Dinner with Andre?
The Vanya on 42nd Street.
Oh, Vanya, yeah.
So, yeah, but different. So, Mark, any thoughts on The Magic Flute?
Yeah, I mean, this one is, I was kind of struggling with, I've been talking about, well, I've got the set, do I pick this up? And I think, like I said before, I think the supplements, if they're not on there, are probably going to get me into it. And my daughter is kind of just getting into Mozart. We just watched Amadeus, which includes some cool snippets, you know, from this this opera. So yeah, we'll definitely check it out. You know, it's probably hard for us to see a staged version of it, so we'll look forward to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Amadeus has to be a great film for kids. I mean that genuinely. I think that did she enjoy it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, her music class this year. Last year, eighth grade, showed it, and she really enjoyed it. They cut out a couple of parts, of course, but so she wanted to rewatch it, and it was a big hit. Yeah, she loves it.
Yeah, so then we have on March 19th, Edgar Ulmer's Detour. So we've known this was coming. In fact, I think a lot of this month has been pretty well known. There aren't a lot of secrets for the people like us that keep up with this sort of thing. But this is a new spine. 966. If you've seen Detour, it's very hard-boiled. I think we've talked about it probably about 10 times because very questionable narration, or it's a great example of the unreliable narrator, I'll say. I don't think that's a spoiler. Is that a spoiler? So have you guys seen Detour?
Oh, I adore Detour. It's great. I think it's one of just the great films. And I mean, this restoration, I went to the Academy Film Archive a few months ago to watch this restoration, and Heather Linville, who was sort of the main person who worked on it, this was a really, really difficult restoration. I know there's a making of about the restoration, which I highly recommend people watch when it comes out. I mean, they basically worked with, they actually found a nitrate print in Belgium, but it had Belgian subtitles, so they had to slowly, meticulously remove those by cross-checking it with a 35mm MoMA. It was just a lot of work, and it looks as great as this film. I mean, it's almost like, you know, this film's famously been in the public domain for years. It feels unfair to be watching it outside of like a VHS copy that you burned off of like some, like, you know, like bum on the street or something, because that feels like more great. And Noah Eisenberg is a friend who is the author of the book on Edgar G. Ulmer, and that book is fantastic. So the interview with him, I'm sure, will be great as well.
I think it'll be amazing. And I think the version I saw, it was not from somebody off the street, but it was not the best restoration. So it'll be interesting seeing like a pristine restoration. And the running time is very short. In fact, somebody else caught the screening, and I saw on social media. It was not the wisest comment in the world, but he said basically that there's a lot for such a short film. There's a lot in there, which is true, I guess. But it flies by, and you're wanting more. But it's really just a revelation. Have you seen it, Mark?
I haven't seen it. No, I'm looking forward to it. I haven't seen many Ulmers, but this one is, it's the first time it's been on Blue, which I guess probably isn't surprising, you know, with the new restoration, but I really look forward to seeing it. I'm kind of struggling a little bit with the tagline and the cover. I think the yellow in the cover will probably grow on me a little bit. It's the first cover from Jennifer Dionisio, I believe it is. So, I mean, just
kind of looks like a safety thing. Yes.
And of course, I was thinking of, you know, like Lost Highway or something. I know Doug would like to see that instead. But yeah, I feel like the yellow is going to grow on me. It's kind of, taking me aback at first. So,
Well, there's no yellow in the film, no teal in the film. So
curiously, they didn't go with red, which may have worked as well.
Yeah, yeah, it is an interesting cover, and having seen the film, aside from just the illustrations of the characters, it doesn't seem to really fit. But one thing I'll say about this film is it really rewards repeat viewings. So you watch it 5 times, Peter. You probably have.
That's probably about right.
Pick up something new every time, and it's really really something special. So. Looking forward to Detour. And then now we have a film that I haven't seen that I've wanted to see for probably a couple decades. So on March 19th, we have Barbara Loden's Wanda, which is on the Sight and Sound 250. So Peter, we'll talk about lists that you should seek out the films. I'd say I'd take that one over IMDb any day, but this is on there. So, and it's one of those that's been on that list that's hard to find. So this is a huge release. So March 19th, I believe this was her only film. I think it was inspired by Cassavetes style. In fact, was he in this? I forget.
No, he's not in it. Barbara Loden was married to Ilya Kazan, though. At the time that she made this. It's her only feature. I see she did a couple of shorts sort of for educational programming, and one of them is on this disc, The Frontier Experience, which is sort of a Western. It's really good, actually.
Okay.
But Wanda is just absolute masterpiece. It's
that's
just a flat-out masterpiece, you know, like, especially when people talk about the rarity of women's filmmaking even in the New Hollywood era. Mm-hmm. There weren't as many women as you'd hope or expect to be, but this film is just a flat-out, like, A-grade psychological masterpiece. It's also very funny. It's, like, almost, it almost has that element, you know, if people remember Bonnie and Clyde, there's actually a lot of, like, heist comedy. There's an element of heist comedy in this film as well, but it's just so psychologically perceptive about its character. It's been impossible to see this. UCLA, with funding through Martin Scorsese's Film Foundation, did a restoration of the 16mm in 2007, and then there was an educational DVD you could buy for $250, which meant nobody could see it except if you saw a rare screening. Did it ever show up on Filmstruck?
I don't believe it wasn't. Yeah, but that's a tough source subject still.
Yeah, I guess this would have come to Filmstruck eventually, given the new restoration touring. But now people can watch it, and it's just flat out will devastate you.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it'll probably come out on the Criterion Channel when they release it, which I believe is spring-ish. We're not really certain, but that's what they're targeting. So, it looks like great discovery, and I'm guessing you're with me and haven't seen it, Mark, right?
Yeah, same here. Yeah, I mean, I think really looking at this list, jumping ahead, this is my most anticipated of the month. Another cover by Eric Skillman that, you know, it's only a still from the film, but I love it. It feels like a perfect facial expression with the woman kind of looking at her from behind, and that the grain kind of texture of cinema verite in the frame, you know, and on the cover. Mm-hmm. So if it doesn't grab you, and of course, you know, if you don't like, as some of my friends say, depressing cinema, this may not be for you, but I'm ready to be like Peter said, I'm ready to be devastated. Yeah. So,
and then again, it's very funny at times though.
Okay. Right. Yeah. And that's where I think of the Cassavetes, because, and maybe there's no inspiration. I haven't seen this, but when I think of him, I think of, well-constructed and with a little, not afraid to have some grain in the shot.
Right.
I forget if she's talked about it at all in terms of Cassavetes, but definitely was made in that sense.
Yeah, and right around the time of A Woman Under the Influence. And so, switching gears, the next one is March 26th, Steven Spielberg presents Robert Zemeckis's I Want to Hold Your Hand. So if you've been looking for Robert Zemeckis to join the collection, well, you have your wish. So we had a newsletter clue about this, nice pun on Iguana Hold Your Hand. I've probably seen this. I don't remember it. It looks like Peter is chomping at the bit.
I love this movie
really?
So much.
Okay, that's what I
mean. I'm a huge Robert Zemeckis fan. I just saw Welcome to Marwen, which I think I'm going to be alone in many people thinking it's actually really, really perceptive and interesting. But this is like, I mean, I love that early Bob Gale Zemeckis. I think 1941, the Spielberg movie, is an absolute masterpiece as well.
I like it too.
So the story, of course, is about four girls trying to make it to the Ed Sullivan Show for the Beatles. I mean, the thing plays like live action Looney Tunes, and it with all the color, pizzazz, and everything you expect. I think all the cast is just fantastic. It's so silly, and certainly maybe a slight film in a lot of ways, but I just find it absolutely adorably and so well constructed. It reminds me a lot of like Frank Tashlin films from the 50s.
Yeah, stylistically, we have quite a mixed bag this month, and that'll continue with the next one. But yeah, we have a silent comedy. We have this Zemeckis. This was his first feature, right?
It was.
Yep.
Yeah, and then, of course, we have Bergman and Wanda. So yeah, I like I said, I haven't seen it. So there's a pretty good. There's new interviews. We saw that Zemeckis and Gale were at the collection, and I believe Spielberg was with them as well. So. That was probably where they recorded this conversation. We have Nancy Allen, who did not spoil her release this time. If people remember, she spoiled, was it Dressed to Kill? One of them.
Sounds right.
So, yeah. Mark, have you seen I Want to Hold Your Hand?
I haven't. This is continuing a trend with Criterion, how they keep seemingly releasing the first feature for a director, which I really like. I think it's, I'm going to talk about a first feature a little bit later that's in the collection, but it seems like Criterion does it really well in how they, I don't know if it's, you know, due to the ease of obtaining the rights to some of the early movies or, but also I think to provide context to what we know as an already established career. They did that with Christopher Nolan with Following. So, and this 5.1 soundtrack, of course, you know, gets me where I'm happy. So this is, you know, and the early shorts, I really excited to see this. And a little bit of buttering for Peter. I think his upcoming show with Keith about the top films of the year, one of my favorite things is to hear about you wax a little poetic, Peter, about the movies that nobody else likes that you guys enjoy. So luckily I don't have to make my list for another couple months. So, you know, I usually add a couple of things that you guys at least have on that show. So that's a big two-parter coming soon. Looking forward to it.
Yep.
Cool. Yeah, I look forward to it as well. Now, one thing, Zemeckis isn't thought of as an auteur, and I think that's because he's Hollywood. But I agree, Peter. I think he's a really good filmmaker, and I like Contact. I think one of the least, and maybe it's just because I saw them when I was a kid, is Back to the Future series doesn't resonate as much for me as it does for other people.
No.
But Romancing the Stone, Used Cars is really fun, too.
Used Cars is fun. And I'm a big fan of this late period he's been in since sort of, I guess, you know, I think the motion capture films like Beowulf and A Christmas Carol are interesting. I won't go.
I kind of like Beowulf. It was, yeah.
But, I think Flight is fantastic. I think Allied was great. The Walk was phenomenal. Yeah. I think this last sort of period, I think those of you who see Welcome to Marwen, it reminds me a lot of Spielberg's Ready Player One, where a filmmaker's really grappling with the legacy of his own creations. And there's a very, very strong, I mean, Dave Kerr compared it to Vertigo, and it's not a unwarranted connection. I mean, there's a direct Vertigo citation in the film, and it's a lot about someone who's, you know, uses fantasy to sort of create an alternate world and without paying attention to what reality represents. So I think it's a good film. I understand why people absolutely hate it, especially compared to the documentary Marwen Cole in terms of what it does with the story, but I find it quite perceptive and interesting. And I just adore Zemeckis. I think he's always going to be perpetually underrated for years to come.
Well, my wife wants to see Marwen, so I'll go in it with an open mind. But
yeah, first time on Blue for this one too. For I Want to Hold Your Hand. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's been in the UK and France, but first in the US. So it's cool.
Cool. All right. Well, the last one is another first film in the collection for somebody, and that is somebody that I'm really looking forward to, Carlo Regatta.
Regattas.
So we had Sean on. I think you've talked to Sean as well, and he's worked with the DP, Sean Baker. And he was really looking forward to the he loves Regattas, but I haven't seen this one. It's early film of his. I don't think it's his first, but it's...
I think it is his first.
Is it? Okay. So it's another debut.
First feature.
Yeah.
And they've got, it looks like, a short of his that he made around the same time, or a few years before, on the film. and the disc.
There are rumors there are more to come, and I think there's a lot there to mine. I've gone on record about how much I love Post-Hennibus Lux quite a bit.
Mm. Yeah, I'm hoping for Silent Light.
So I have not seen this one, but it's a little longer. There's some interesting features. I like the cover, actually.
Yeah. Big fan.
And cover's great.
Have you seen this, Peter?
No, and I'm not particular on Carlos Regattas, actually. He's like one of my film enemies in a lot of ways. I even Silent Light, I have strong issues with, even though I've taught scenes from it in classes. But I find him really, really trying in a lot of ways. But I'm glad everyone else can like him, and I'll go elsewhere.
Well, we appreciate
that. I'll just stick to Bob Zemeckis. My true art house-ness comes out when we talk about Robert Zemeckis. And then when we get to, you know, impoverished Mexican cinema, I'm like, nope, that's trash.
Pass. Well, I'm looking forward to it. Again, it's a 16mm, I guess, upscale and restored, supervised by Carlos Regattas. I'm looking forward. I don't have a lot to say because I know nothing about this. I think it's great to bring more attention, as Peter said dismissively, to Mexican cinema and South American cinema, which he's also, I believe he is from South America, right?
Mexico.
Oh, he is from Mexico. Okay. Have you seen much, Mark, besides Silent Light?
I saw Silent Light, and then I did see this one, and not too long ago on the DVD. And you know, neither one was a very good print, but you know, it certainly was an odd journey for me. And there's an interview on there where he talks about his influences, and it's a laundry list of directors in the Criterion Collection, like Bresson and Dreyer and Rossellini. Even talks about the Dardens being an influence, and of course Tarkovsky and Kiarostami. So there's your list. Yeah, but
can see all those.
Yeah.
And I think that Peter's point is I could definitely see him trying too hard or being a little indulgent and maybe not have. I mean, he's not a Tarkovsky, but from what I've seen is I like, and I really did like Post-Hennibus Lux. So yeah, I'm interested.
Yeah. No, he's certainly someone to reckon with or something. It's interesting, though, that's like one of the things that I think I'd struggle with in a lot of ways is you mentioned his influences, and influence are very European, and he's sort of making this European art house film in Mexico, and I'm often more interested in sort of what I would call indigenous cinema, maybe be a term that you'd say. Like 2 years ago, here in UCLA, we did a giant series of both films from Mexico, Argentina, and Spanish language films made in the United States that were made around the early sound period and going into the 40s that played to Latino audiences in Los Angeles. And like that was an amazing series. And I almost like the classical Hollywood version of Mexican cinema more than sort of a lot of the stuff that contemporary plays in art houses.
Yeah, who was it? Somebody had...
Not to talk about Roma.
Oh, yeah. No, right. We can go there. Yay Roma or nay Roma, Peter?
It's fine.
Okay. Yeah, we definitely won't talk about Roma then. So, okay, well, that's the March slate. So I think it's pretty amazing. Yeah, even though not many surprises, I think it's... so there's six titles, first of all. I think that's
month.
The first six-title month. Peter, do you buy a lot of discs, or are you more digital? Or I know that's a sore subject these days.
I should say I'm more theatrical more than anything else. I sort of just watch a lot of things at home, or not at home, sorry, in theaters. If I'm watching something at home, I don't really buy that many discs. Occasionally, one or two. Like I might get like the I Want to Hold Your Hand, because especially with the soundtrack, it'll sound great. More often. Still what I do is I do Turner Classic Movies. Like they still have their Watch TCM app that supplements the cable subscription if you have that, and that's always where I discover really, really good, you know, rare off the beat Hollywood films.
Yeah, we just had a TCM employee, well, not employee, she would correct me, freelance employee, on last episode. So I love TCM, and I love theatrical. That's one thing with us trying to move. We're half a mile from the theater, our local theater, and of course we're in a smaller market. But looking forward to being a little more theatrical myself. Have not yet because we're moving all the time, so give us a couple weeks. Although we are going to Die Hard on Wednesday.
Oh, excellent.
So,
fantastic.
So we can finally settle that debate of whether it's a Christmas movie.
Can't wait to hear.
So anyway, December releases have wrapped up, so we have a year of Criterion in the books. And this month we had Sam Fuller's 40 Guns, and I don't have it in front of me, A Dry White Season. I forget the name of the director.
Palsy. Yeah. Usain Palsy.
Palsy, yep. Yeah. So, one of my favorites, Panique.
Some guy named DuBivier.
Yeah. Yeah, so in fact, I just got that this week, and the other two are arriving tomorrow because they went on sale. Peter, have you seen any of this grouping?
Actually, none of them. I'm a huge Sam Fuller and Barbara Stanwyck fan, so I still need to see 40 Guns. I just missed it here and there. And I guess I'm curious about the other two as well.
Masters of Cinema put out 40 Guns, too, but I haven't seen that version.
They did. Have you seen much DuBivier? Or
what have I seen? I've seen a few of his films, and he's interesting. You know, I'm trying to think which films I've... Oh, I've seen Pepe Le Moko.
Right. Oh, yeah, of course. And this compares pretty well. It's not the same. It's made not quite a decade, but you know there's a war between those films. This is, I think, a little darker. Pepe Le Moko is pretty dark. So, and then there's also coming soon. We have the Bergman box set. This is the first time they've done this. They've listed it as a new release because it sold out, which is fantastic. I'm very very thrilled that this was so well received. And Peter, I don't know if you're gonna be in the market for it, but it'll be out on February 26th again. I guess the second printing.
I did not get it the first round, so we'll see what happens in February and how I'm feeling about getting a giant box set.
It is a brick. In fact, it's tough to figure out what to do with. We have ours, well, by the TV, of course, but...
It's where I've got my John Ford at Fox box set right now.
Ooh, yeah, still that's also a big doorstopper there. I don't have that one, but I love John Ford. All right, guys. Well, there's been a pretty big revelation for home media, and we mentioned Kino earlier. So Studio Canal has made a deal, and we've talked about that a few times on this show, that they have a couple of titles coming out, and they announced some Melville and some others. A lot of Ealing classics, which are, to me, a big deal. All the Guinness and Man in the White Suit, Lavender Hill Mob, and, of course, Kind Hearts and Coronets, which is a big one. But this week, and this was sort of a spoiler, but they announced last year at Marion Bad, Alphaville, and Port of Shadows are coming out this year from 2019 from Studio Canal. And they also mentioned more Melville, which is probably going to be a Criterion title, and more Carol Reed, which you know, could be, I'm thinking Fallen Idol, but it could be The Third Man. You know, I'm okay with that. I saw in our social media circles, people were like, damn, I wanted Criterion to get those. But, you know, if they bring up stuff like Wanda, you know, it's not like they're going to not release movies. So,
Yeah. And I mean, as full disclosure, as someone who's worked for Kino Lorber, I think their releases actually look really, really great. The restoration work is always fantastic. Well, whether they're doing restoration work themselves or, you know, sourcing it out to archive, they have a lot of great, you know, trustworthy, and they always get very good essayists, including yours truly, that I think do a lot of great work. And I was just looking at, I saw this sort of release list that they kind of had going on. I mean, like Jacques Rivette's The Nun, which I saw the new restoration at Il Cinema Ritrovato in Bologna last summer. The restoration looks phenomenal. The film is even better than the restoration. So that's and then I was just looking at some of this other stuff, like Douglas Sirk's A Tarnished Angels is like just flat out masterpiece. Spike Lee's Jungle Fever, I adore. The Great McGinty from Preston Sturges.
Great McGinty is
a
great
Kundin.
One.
Kundin's going to be interesting. I've never seen Kundin, but I've been waiting to see it in a good version. So
I haven't seen it either. There was actually a Brick too, which is strange. So quite a diverse slate. But I mean, that's really Kino. They put out a lot of films, those won't be on Criterion. There's a lot of speculation whether they're going to get maybe The Third Man, they'll release Ron. I would think that if Criterion had their pick, just because of they value their collection, I think they would go with Grand Illusion because that's Spine One, and they'd want to have Spine One on Blu-ray. I think it Port of Shadows, if people haven't seen that, that's just really a terrific film, kind of a pre-noir noir, that poetic realism noir. I'm looking forward to revisiting Alphaville. I didn't really get it the first time, didn't get into it. And Marion Bad is Marion Bad, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm with you there, though, Aaron. I mean, these are losses, but you know, we already have, for those that have purchased them, some are out of print. Actually, I think all of them are out of print. The Criterion discs and those extras, but you know, there will be a discs from Kino. I know we tend towards Criterion, but you know, to your last point, Criterion can focus their resources on other discs. So we're going to find you may not get these, but you'll get some other films that you know either have seen and love, or haven't seen and will love.
Yep, and also a lot of credit to Kino. I think they're trying to, you know, I guess focus more on the art house element of their library, which they had the Tarkovskys, Wong Kar Wai, not the Sacred Cows. I don't know if they're getting contempt. I think they mentioned, no, I think I saw something about that. I forget, but anyway, I credit them for doing a lot of good work. These box sets, you mentioned the early women filmmakers. There's the African American cinema.
It's
a good home.
I think both Ron and Contempt are still in print on the U.S. Studio Canal, if I remember. But
the Lionsgate, that might be right.
Yeah, so. I mean, I'll just shout out to Rob Sweeney, R. Emmett Sweeney, who's one of the DVD producers there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you talk about the things that I'm just looking at this list that he worked on of things this year. I mean, one of the other films that they put out this year, and one of my absolute favorite films of, I guess, quote unquote, the year it never got released, was Personal Problems from Bill Gunn, the filmmaker behind Ganja and Hess. It was just this experimental 3-hour soap opera shot in early video. It's available through Canopy for those of you who have access to Canopy. I know that's, you know, not in every market based on your public library or university affiliation, but that's really great. You know, it's a phenomenal. But I mean, this year, the things that I know he said he worked on were things like, you know, Manhandled and Stagestruck, which are both Gloria Swanson films. He worked on Tarkovsky's The Sacrifice. There was a couple, Legend of the Mountain, which was a King Hu Hong Kong film.
Yeah, I have that Masters of Cinema. I have not watched it yet, though.
The early Clouseau box set as well. He worked on that one as well. But, you know, I think, I mean, they seem to almost be releasing too much. And I think in that announcement, they're like, we did 800 titles last year. But, like, you know, it's like they cover a lot of bases with that one. I mean, Cabin Boy. Who wanted a Blu-ray of Cabin Boy? And I'll say Nick Pinkerton, who's a really, really great critic, wrote that essay because he adores Cabin Boy.
And that's a great point, actually. The question is, are they casting their net too wide? So will these films, I mean, to us, you know, we're going to notice Marion Bad and Port of Shadows, but to the average viewer, are they going to get it mixed up with, you know, all right, do I buy Cabin Boy or do I buy this cult art, 1930s art film? Speaking of old art films, we also, Janus Films, pretty much announced, I hope I get this name right, Sergei Bondarchuk's 7-hour War and Peace, which, if you've read War and Peace, 7 hours doesn't seem terribly long, but they're going to tour that. It's going to play Lincoln Center Film Society, so that'll probably tour elsewhere. I did ask my local theater. I'm on the board there, and we had our programming committee this weekend. I was like, 7-hour Russian film,
they're
Tolstoy,
all in, right?
How about it? And they're just like, no Aaron, no, stop. Because I was fortunate to do the intro to Andrei Rublev a few weeks back. So I have not seen this. It's been on my list of stuff I wanted to see it for a while. Peter, you reacted there.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is I was about to take a Soviet cinema class in college, and it was just a really poorly designed class for various reasons in terms of its theoretical bent or whatever. But the homework for the first week was to go to the library, rent the VHS of this version, and where you could only watch in the library for seven, and it, of course it's 7.5 hours, and I was just like, I'm sorry, like, you know, there's like, I don't want to be like the person, like, I understand with my own students now, like, they complain about 40 pages of reading. I'm like, that's an hour work, but I'm like, I don't have 7.5 hours to spend in a library watching a bad VHS of a film. So, but I've been curious about this version. I know, like, you know, there's a lot of really great histories of Most Film and the other companies that were working during the Soviet era. And I think one of the things that I'm curious about is, like, I think we think of, like, Tarkovsky, who played more to European audiences. And I don't know if this version ever really played outside the Soviet bloc. Maybe played some festivals or something. So, you know, I'm always curious about the Soviet for Soviet films, even though I know it's a little on the prestige. I think this was like, you know, people talk about Solaris being made for 2001 Space Odyssey. I think this was like people saw Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago and, you know, someone, Khrushchev, you know, pounded the thing. We need our own Dr. Zhivago.
Or and Tarkovsky too, you know, Andrei Rublev was made for Russians because he was a celebrated icon painter, really a celebrity in the Soviet era, but turned out to be an international success, and he hit the rest of his films were not really made for Russia. In fact, specifically, were not made for Russia because they didn't receive him too well. But I don't know much about it either stylistically, if it's going to be more, you know, Kalizatov or more, I don't know. Everything seems from the Soviet area I've seen is a little artistic, but
I mean, the filmmaker I always like to highlight, and I know they just did a restoration of a couple of his films that I don't know. I think they were going to come to Kino Lorber or whatever, is Alexei Garman. I think a few people saw his most recent film, or his last film, his Hard to Be a God. But Krystolyov, My Car, which was made in the 90s, is really great. My friend Ivan Lapshin from the 80s, and he made films in the 60s like Trial at the Road. And I'm forgetting the other titles, but he's just like, I hate to be the person that's like, he is my Tarkovsky. Like, I love Tarkovsky a lot. He's really important. But, like, I'll take an Alexei Garman film any day over Tarkovsky.
I made the mistake of trying, going in blind and trying Hard to Be a God when I was sick. So,
yeah, you could just imagine.
You got to be have a firm fortitude. Yeah. You have to
gotta be awake.
Have not eaten for 3 hours and got to be awake. It wasn't really the pacing wasn't really the problem. It was everything else.
This frame, so this frame kind of reminds me of Sokurov. You know, if I'm going to compare him to a director, but you know, again, haven't seen the film.
Post-Soviet, I love Russian film. I would have loved that class, but yeah, we talked about it on the last episode. The whole concept of a reserved copy of a library is pretty outdated, and I'm glad we're beyond that, even if things like Filmstruck are not there. So, all right, well, that's really kind of the high points of the news. There's a lot that happened this month, and we're at the end of the year. So, and I should mention that the Criterion cast, they actually just last night, in fact, Ryan just texted me saying, hey, our Best of the Year episode is up, I think they recorded for like 4 hours. So that'll I can't wait to listen, but I could not join. So we have our sequence short takes where we just talk about a Criterion we've seen lately, and we go alphabetical order. But Mark, since Peter's our esteemed guest, can I start with Peter? Because I know what he's going to choose, and it's one of my favorites of all time. So, Peter, what do you got?
Sure. So it's very funny. It's been actually a while since I've watched any Criterion films either at home. But, you know, so I taught this history of silent film and early sound film class at USC this year. And we were working through, you know, we do a lot to sort of expand the canon. So we show Lois Weber film instead of a D.W. Griffith film. For our class on Russian Soviet film, we did the peasant women of Ryazan over sort of, you know, Man with a Movie Camera or Battleship Potemkin. You know, just trying to do different work, whatever. But of course, you know, there's certain narratives that you have to tell, and we end the class in the 1930s, we do a class on sound, and we did a Mexican film, Ayo en Rancho Grande. But our last class was about the sort of politicization of cinema that happens in the 30s. And we compared two filmmakers, Leni Riefenstahl and Jean Vigo. You know, we talked about the development of fascism and the fascist aesthetics that were used in films like Olympia and Judgment at Nuremberg, or not Judgment at Nuremberg, that's the other one. what is the film I'm like thinking of? Triumph of the Will.
Triumph of the Will, yeah.
And then compared to the anarchistic films of Jean Vigo, I mean, less so in La Atalanta, the Criterion film I talking about that we watched in full, but we watched sequences from Zero de Conduit and, of course, Apropos Denise. But I hadn't seen La Atalante in a while, and I was just kind of struck by it in a lot of ways. Once again, particularly, you know, there's this romance, of course, at the center between... you know, this working class man who runs a barge that travels through the rivers of France and his newly beloved wife. But I was so struck by Michel Simon's performance in the film. He is sort of this bumbling comic, very much in the same sense that he developed in films like Beau Save from Drowning, you know, where he's just such this this hearty fool, almost reminds me of Chaplin in certain ways, but not certainly with the sophistication. And it just feels like such a different style of film acting from not just anyone else in the film, but I think a lot of different people at the time. And, you know, La Atalante, it's a film, interesting, I was just thinking about in the context that we taught, but the what makes it so surprising is I think its strong vision of a working class cinema, of depicting the working class, and not in a sort of way of like, look at how harsh their life is or look at how rough they have it. There's certainly trials and hardships, but it's sort of this utopic celebration that these people have this barge where they are allowed to be free and explore, and they're not held by any sort of societal standards except, you know, making it to the next city. And they, of course, they're never on time, and it doesn't matter anyway. And I think that's what really, really struck me. And of course, Vigo made it so beautifully. Of course, everyone loves that sequence. When he peeks into the river and sees this vision of his wife who has gone lost at this time. And it's really romantic. If this, of course, was Vigo's only feature film, because he sadly died a couple years later. But
we can
always wonder how many films he could have made. And, of course, this restoration that was made by Criterion and the Cinémathèque Francoise in the about a decade ago, you know, restored what had been a brutally massacred version of the film. And it's great. And I think it was a great film to end the semester on, of just this, you know, beautiful, artistic, but friendly and open film that is really, really wonderful.
Yeah, I don't know if you know, but I'm 1930s French is my thing. And and so I've done a lot of studying and actually in class on Vigo. And yeah, La Atalante is... for Vigo and how anarchist he was, it's very apolitical. You know, it's kind of like just his vision of the world under his ideology, but it doesn't force the ideology. Unlike like Zero de Conduit or Apropos Denis, phenomenal filmmaker, died too soon. I think actually La Atalante killed him because he poured so much, and he was very frail. A really tragic story, but really interesting story. So... good choice there, and nice opposite side of the coin to what's her name, Riefenstahl.
Yeah,
you couldn't get further from the left and right. So, Mark, what's yours?
Mine is, so of course I had to go see Roma this week in the theater before it left the theater, and could only see it on Netflix. So I figured I needed to pair that with a film, his first film that I think is. Maybe forgotten in the collection a little bit. We think of Itu Mama Tambien, which is in the collection, but his first movie, if I can say this correctly, Solo con tu pareja, is there. And this is when I was watching it, I thought of really a screwball comedy. And I don't know if that really applies, because I don't think there's really a struggle between the classes in this, class differences, but you know, doing some reading, it does seem to apply. I can't say this is a great film. It does have some nice cinematography. Lubezki is there, if folks aren't aware. But it does, I don't know. I guess I think of this in relation to his other movies, and I read that you can see some comparisons with Roma, and there is some plane imagery in this film, even more so, I think, in this movie than Roma. And I think... just what I took from watching this and compared to some other Cuarón films is I think he's getting at kind of the ascension of a person above themselves and their place in a world. So, you know, this is in this film, the character is someone who is really a womanizer, and he finds another way to be throughout this movie. I won't really say more than that. It does comment on the AIDS epidemic too, back in the you know, the early 90s here. But it's also, you know, so he's looking for something greater than just the conquest of women, which is what we see him doing. And that, I think, kind of plays into what we see the Clive Owen character doing in Children of Men. Really, I mean, he's what's a greater cause than he's really fighting for the survival of the human race. And then in Roma, again, a lot of people haven't seen it, but there is, you could say, an ascension there. So I really took that with this film, and so it helped me kind of come to grips with something that I'm seeing in Caron's film. But it's a fun film, you know, a bit of a lark. It's an hour and a half, and you could do worse. It is pretty explicit in a number of scenes, so I think it wasn't shown in many places. So, but I think it is on Amazon Prime and, of course, on the Criterion DVD. So I'll give it a mild recommendation. Mm-hmm.
Tom Bien had a little bit of explicitity yes. as well. So,
truth.
Roma, not so much. I haven't seen it. It's been on my shelf, and I think because it's not as heralded as one of his masterworks. But yeah, I'm curious. Maybe
yeah.
So well, mine. I just moved into a new house, and I had boxes and boxes of media, and they were, so I just had to take them out of boxes and find stuff to watch. So so I just pretty much grabbed an oldie but a goodie that I hadn't seen in a while. In fact, I hadn't seen the Criterion edition. So, but I wanted something light too, because you and so I chose Night of the Hunter as my light film.
Just like a Criterion fan. Nice work, Aaron.
Well, you know, compared to say actually Lotta's pretty light too.
You could have put on Sala, right. Let's say.
There you go. There's always Sala. I could have put on our Tarkovsky, since we name dropped him a few times. But I think it's an easily watchable film. It has a very iconic villain. You know, it speaks to a lot of the innocence of childhood. You know, what is it? What do you think of the children? Yeah. And the trusting of adults. And it's a very enjoyable film. However, you know, however difficult the situation is. You know, it's kind of a chase film as these kids, mm-hmm. you know, try to find, I guess, their safe haven. And yeah, it's kind of like, you know, for a challenging film, kind of like a warm spot. So I saw it. It had been about 10 years, and it was just a great way to christen the new film, or the new house, Night of the Hunter, Love and Hate.
Aaron, did you do one of those? Did you just like take one of the boxes, stick your hand in, and then just pick something out, and that's what you watched, or was it?
No, I put all of my discs against the wall, and there's a lot of discs, and I'd seen most of them, so I was just looking for something, and I was like, all right, I need something that I'll rewatch. Right. I watched a lot of I started the early Sam Fuller, and I watched some Harryhausen too. So speaking of light, so yeah. Lots of choices, and I wanted to get into the William Castle set, but I couldn't find it. So, yeah.
Eventually.
Eventually. It'll show up. So, well, that's really it for the show. And the last segment we have is our piece of flair, so just something that we're into at the moment. So Mark, do you have a piece
of flair? Sure. I paired a couple quick things. So my local film foundation shows a movie every month, which I went to see. And I feel like this one isn't on people's radars, and I think it should be. It didn't blow me away, but I liked it a lot. It's a film called, it was just released in October in the U.S., called Liana, from a couple of directors, a couple, Aaron Kopp and Amanda Kopp. It's a really interesting mix of documentary and animation. It's only about 75 minutes long. Mm. It's about five children in Swaziland, and they are really writing their own story and describing it. And there's talking heads describing the story mixed with the animation of the story itself. And the editing of those two together, I really, really loved. So it's and it's really informed by the fact that from a documentary standpoint, 25% of the adult population there in Swaziland are infected with AIDS. So there are many, many orphans there, sadly. And so you get to really, through the telling of this story and some of the short interviews, get a sense of these kids. So it's a bit heavy there, but it's also a fun story and really fun to watch them watch it. So that's my recommendation, Liana. And for a Christmas movie, I just wanted to recommend, I'd never seen the original Miracle on 34th Street, the 1947 version. And all I got to say is Edmund Gwenn won the best actor for playing Santa Claus. You know, one of the most iconic characters of all time, Santa Claus. So
I didn't realize he did the Oscar.
Yeah. So it's really great. The family loved it. So another classic Christmas hit for the Herney family.
Good job. Peter, do you have something?
Yes. So over the last couple of months, I've been spending a lot of time at the UCLA Film and Television Archive. They're the largest film archive connected to a university in the world, and they also put on great programming. But there was a series that just wrapped up. It was programmed by KJ Ralph in relation with Mark Toscano from the Academy Film Archive, where Mark has been working with the queer experimental filmmaker Barbara Hammer and restoring her giant set of films. We're talking like, I think something like 100 films, a lot of them shorts or what have you as experimentals, but some of the most incredible work I've seen. And I saw probably about 30 films over the entire series. And I was just blown away by this filmmaker whose work goes from, I mean, there's stuff that's very, very defiantly queer. And she's written great books about, at the time when she was becoming a filmmaker, there wasn't anything really to conceive of, particularly as a woman queer filmmaker in the 1970s. So she kind of had to figure out what the language of her own movies would be, because her identity had never been represented. So there's films that are like very funny and silly, films that are much more serious and documentary based, and films that are all over the place stylistically, and just really, really interesting things that feel like very much in terms of, like, if you've seen some stuff by Stan Brakhage, where it's a lot of not necessarily hand painted, though with a lot of playing with frames, but, you know, a lot of jagged rhythmic cutting or what have you. I just was blown away by this filmmaker whose work I had only seen one or two films before, and just loved going through the plethora. So Mark has been restoring them a lot from film to film, but with some digital work as well. My hope is that those are going to travel, and that at some point there will be a box set, or they'll end up on Canopy or something like that. I mean, they're just really, really phenomenal work, especially her feature from 1992, Nitrate Kisses, which is about, as it would be right in my wheelhouse, but about how queer voices get written out of archives, and where you can find and restore their voices in a lot of ways, whether it be oral history or sort of novels, or, and it gets a lot into the Holocaust or what have you. But the film that I can recommend that is from her is this film that's actually not made by her, though it is her or not. It's actually three artists at once. The filmmaker is Deborah Strotman, and the film is called Vivere. It's actually commissioned by the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. Shout out to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and my... they've been commissioning some films over the few years, including by Apichpong, Weir Sekaku, and I think Kevin Jerome Everson. There's another film. So this film's on their website, and I think we'll put a link in the show notes until January 5th or 6th. So Deborah Strotman, who's also a female experimental filmmaker, took footage from Barbara Hammer, from an unmade film she made in Guatemala in the 1970s, I believe, and talks to Barbara about the film, as well as uses the music from Meshes of the Afternoon, the film by Maya Deren, as well as text from Maya Deren about her own experience of trying to make a film in an indigenous land. And what you see is, so you see this amazing footage of Guatemala and particularly a market, but you also have these filmmakers who are wrecking with their privileged position as white women trying to make films about indigenous cultures. And the film is ultimately about that failure, that they cannot represent the gaze accurately, but they can represent their own gaze of failing to represent the gaze, which is really, really interesting in a way that I don't think male filmmakers necessarily often believe. They just believe that they can do it, instead of, this is a film about realizing you need to pull back. It's only 12 minutes long. Yeah, the footage is gorgeous. And of course, you can only watch it on the Walker Art Center website. So I would say check it out.
Well, hopefully it will come to Canopy. And by the way, I do get Canopy, and it really is a gem. I get 10 a month, so I have to be very selective. So lately they've been Wiseman, so that get my money's worth, or not my money, my taxpayers' money's worth. Yeah, I see. Just it's credited with Maya Darren as the writer, so I guess the narration must count as writing. So look forward to that one. Well, mine, again, I was looking for some light movies to watch, so I chose a documentary about a film worker. So it's called Film Worker. It's on Netflix. I believe it came out within the last week, and it's about Leon Vitali, who, if you don't know, he was the son in Barry Lyndon. And shockingly, you know, he had a promising career, and he acted in a few movies, but he was so taken by Kubrick that he decided to become a film worker for him. And really became his, I guess, his assistant, kind of his gopher, kind of his everything. But he really learned the business and became really an invaluable, I guess, spokesperson for Kubrick's library. And in fact, I think he's part of the reason that we're getting a lot of Kubrick restorations back on screen. Like for example, Lyndon. You know, nobody really knew Kubrick's films frame by frame, unlike Vitali. But he spent 30 years with the guy, and you learn as much about Vitali and what he could handle and how and his work ethic. So he Kubrick, I think you can love him as a director, and I think he deserves that. But he was very exacting on what he wanted, and I think he pushed people pretty hard. So Leon is the product of that, and yeah, interesting character study. I think it's a must for people that love film and film about film. So yeah, highly recommended. Have you guys seen it yet?
Yeah, I just got to see it.
No, I haven't, but I just watched Eyes Wide Shut earlier this week because they were playing it at the LA County Museum of Art. And I believe, I don't know if they talk about this, he's the one who plays the leader of the quote-unquote sex cult, the one in the red cloak.
They do. Yeah, and they do, and there's actually a funny anecdote about. So he was working on the film as he was playing that character, and so they talk about how he was really had two roles, and you know that character was not very active, but off screen he was very active. Yeah, really an enjoyable movie, and I don't know if who isn't a Kubrick fan,
absolutely,
but you know if you're a film fan, you can't. You know, it's even if you're not a Kubrick fan, it's really something to enjoy. So Film Worker, and that's it, gentlemen.
Awesome.
So, this is a tough question, Peter. So usually we ask where to find people online, but I know you're taking a sabbatical from social media.
A little bit. I'm usually on Twitter at Labuza Movies. Currently, you won't find that. You can find, I'm posting some stuff to my Cinephilex account, which is twitter.com/Cinephilex. If people are still on Facebook, despite all the issues that they've had over the years, I am on Facebook, and feel free and friend me. Like I just, you know, I don't post anything personal there except for an occasional photo from a travel from my girlfriend and I, but mostly I just post links to whatever I'm working, which is usually just the podcast or what have you. So feel free to friend me on Facebook, and I'll be on Twitter back eventually. And if you want to check out any of my other writing, it's at www.labuzamovies.com.
Awesome.
I wanted to just plug Peter's movie recommendations on the Cinephiliacs too. So if you're not sure what to watch on Mubi, just take a listen to those. Now's a great time to watch Mubi, and yeah, your plugs, Peter, make me want to just forget my collection and watch Mubi all the time. So nice work. I'm on Twitter at Mark Herney. It's HURNE, Letterboxd2, and I just got to a couple of weeks ago. I was on my local public radio station, Vermont Public Radio, talking about some of my favorites, really just more forgotten films.
That was great.
You know, or not necessarily forgotten, but just recommendations for 2018. So I had a really good time there. That was a great opportunity.
That was fun to listen to, and it was nice to, you know, you being a cinephile and speaking with people that speaking to to general audiences.
It's always the toughest thing.
It is, and I think you selected some good films. I think Hereditary was that probably the most challenging film you mentioned. I think you mentioned Bergman too, actually, didn't you?
I mentioned the box set because they asked, you know, about like something, you know, repertory, something that you know you'd recommend that isn't something new. And yeah, I had some crossover with my the other guest that was on because she'd mentioned like Hereditary and she mentioned First Reform that I would have mentioned. So I actually got into a couple horror titles like Revenge, yeah. you know, which is just, you know, lesser seen, right. but yeah. So, you know, got to plug a few. The other funny thing was for kids movies, I was plugging, you know, like Leave No Trace, you know, which is about really about PTSD, but you know, it's,
I still haven't seen it, but I would not think of it as a kid's movie.
It's not a kid's movie, but, you know, for my kids that are a little older, it's a kid's movie. I don't know. So
there you go. Okay. Well, I'm at AWES505 on Twitter. The show's at Criterion Now Facebook group, really. I think that's the best place to find us. And then, of course, on most people listen to this on the Criterion Cast Master Feed. So, all right. Well, thanks for joining me, gentlemen, and enjoy the rest of your day.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much, guys.
Absolutely.